Once in the spring of 1943 he had to land his Arado in Neubrandenburg. In Volume 2 I had accidentally written Breslau, because his plane was to undergo a general engine inspection. However, as this lasted until the next day, he joined his fellow pilots in the hangar and could not believe his eyes. He saw two large Hornbootus standing there. He got into this security area with his red travel pass, a security ID. He spent the next few hours with the pilots and learned a great deal about these flying objects. He was told that they could easily fly 50,000 km per hour and even over 100,000 km per hour outside the Earth's atmosphere. While he was able to look at the discs from the outside, he was told that they were equipped with an anti-gravity drive that worked according to the counter-rotating principle of a squeezed lemniscate. The counter-rotating discs inside the spaceship created a further dynamo effect. This effect would cause the spaceships to build up a zero field around themselves, and they would continually suck themselves into this zero field. Depending on where this field was directed, it would pull the ship in. This drive would cause jerky movements, for example 22.5 degrees, that would only be visible from the outside, but would not be felt inside. Inside the ships, no centrifugal forces would act on the pilots, as the ships have their own gravitational field. The informant believes that the Germans would have been on the moon with these as early as 1928, if not at the turn of the century. He does not rule this out because, in his opinion, the origin of the technology used here was not Nikola Tesla, but the inventor Harvey, who had already experimented with counter-rotating discs in the 17th century and had supposedly already implemented the principles of motion of hyperbolic bodies in practical physics. The next morning, an exploratory flight around the Earth was to take place. According to one of the pilots, this should be possible in about 5 hours. Of course, the whole crew was standing outside the gates at sunrise to witness this fantastic event and to see these strange flying machines fly with their own eyes. He described that only a quiet humming could be heard and that the Hornbus moved away from the airfield very slowly, at about 600,700 meters, until there was a sudden jolt and the discs disappeared like lightning. And he continues. When I was sitting there with a pilot, he also told me that these flying machines do not break the sound barrier. Today I am personally convinced that these things were used to give the bigwigs the opportunity to escape. That is the case today too. He is probably referring to the Illuminati and other rulers who also keep such secret weapons for their own purposes. At that time they tried to use the moon as a relay station to get to Mars. But today we know that this is not possible. So they must have flown from the moon directly to Venus. I do not want to say more about whether that worked. Only that this is the background to the whole secrecy surrounding the German flying discs. Comment: didn't George Adamski have contacts with Venusians? When asked whether he had ever stood next to one during a launch, he said that he had seen such flying discs take off on 4 different occasions. But each time of a different design. Once he stood at the launch of a V7 disc, with a conventional turbine drive, about 50 meters away and described the turbine noise as a not unpleasant singing, between whistling and singing. In contrast to the jerky movements of the anti-gravity flying discs, this conventional disc flew away elegantly like an airplane, but could also fly upside down or on its side. But the disc principle, of the drive, was already outdated at that time. He explains that the newer engines of the German flying discs no longer had any moving parts at all. In 2 other cases he had then seen the elegant vril discs, without a bell, just with a streamlined dome, which he liked best. What happened to the flying ships after the war? It cannot be completely ruled out that a small series of the Hornbootu was produced. The various UFO photos that appeared after 1945 with the very typical appearance of these German designs suggest this possibility. Some say that some of them were sunk in the Mondsee in Upper Austria, others say that they were flown to South America or brought there in individual parts. What is certain is that, even if the missiles did not necessarily end up in South America, new ones were at least built and flown there based on blueprints, as an important part of this technology was used in the Phoenix experiment in 1983, Montauk Project, which was the follow-up project to the Philadelphia experiment of 1943. These are teleportation, materialization and time travel experiments by the U.S. Navy that were more successful than most people could imagine in their wildest dreams. German scientists and the Croatian physicist Nikola Tesla, 1856-1943, were also involved in this. See the books The Montauk Project, Return to Montauk and Pyramids of Montauk by Preston Nichols and Peter Moon, available from Aldebaran and Versand, see Appendix. In 1938, a German Antarctic expedition was carried out with the catapult ship Schwabenland. 600,000 square kilometers were declared German land, New Swabia, an ice-free area with mountains and lakes. Whole fleets of submarines of the types 21 and XX2I were later on their way to New Swabia. There are supposedly still over 100 German submarines missing today, which were also equipped with the water snorkel, which allowed them to stay underwater for several months. In April 1995, I had an interview with a former officer of the German Reichsmarine who assured me that the Aldebaranians had physically helped to develop the new types of submarine. He described a beautiful man, about 2.10 meters tall, with almond-shaped eyes, a light complexion and long blonde hair. He described the Aldebaranians' clothing as a kind of tight-fitting overall, which, however, seemed to be made of one piece without zippers, seams or buttons. But he had another special feature. In front of his eyes, about 20 centimeters apart, two purple rings floated in the air, like glasses that you hold away from your eyes. These rings, he said, always moved with the movement of the Aldebaranian's head. According to his report, the submarines were also equipped with Schauberger technology. The front was egg-shaped, which caused the water to spiral around the submarines. The Aldebarans were the propulsion system that enabled the submarines to travel at such enormous speeds, officially 170 kilometers per hour, but allegedly up to 300 kilometers per hour. While I am revising this chapter, I get a call telling me that Major General Retired Reimer, when he was guided through Peenemünde in 1944, was shown a man who was over 2 meters tall, wore a strange, straight suit and had long blonde hair. And he had golden rings floating about 25 centimeters in front of his eyes. He was told that this was one of the Markabians, or perhaps they also said Aldebarans. The statement of Major General, Ret, Reimer is almost identical to that of the member of the German Navy, except that the rings in front of his alien's eyes were violet. It can therefore be assumed that some of the members of the Vril Society fled to New Swabia after the end of the war with the flying discs, perhaps with disassembled ones or just with construction plans. This assumption may seem a little bold to some, but there are strong indications that this could have been the case. The question arises as to why the Allies under Admiral E. Byrd invaded Antarctica in 1947, thereby breaking the armistice with the German Reich that had been signed with Grand Admiral Dönitz. Why did Byrd have almost 4,000 soldiers, a warship, a fully equipped aircraft carrier with a complete supply system if it was only to be an expedition? He had 8 months at his disposal, but had to abort after only 8 weeks and a high and never publicly disclosed number of aircraft losses. What had happened? Lee Vanater, newspaper correspondent with El Mercurio, Santiago, Chile, who was approved as a journalist for the expedition, reported on his interview with Byrd on March 5, 1947 in the largest daily newspaper in South America as follows. Admiral Byrd announced today that the United States must necessarily take protective measures against the possibility of an invasion of the country by enemy aircraft coming from the polar region. The admiral said that he did not want to frighten anyone, but the bitter reality is that in the event of a new war, the United States could be attacked by aircraft capable of flying from one pole to the other. He then noted that if he had been successful, Other people could also carry out an expedition, consisting of 4,000 North American young men with the sole support of a handful of experienced researchers. The Admiral emphasized the need to remain alert and vigilant along the entire ice belt, which was the last bulwark against invasion. Admiral Byrd also reported what the land the Germans had chosen looked like. They spoke of a fairy tale valley and signs of vegetation. The bare rocks, however, reflected so much heat that a whole curtain of meltwater streams flowed across the ice to the cold coast. Byrd discovered a similar area in 1929 during his South Pole flight. He spoke of lush green grass, flowers and animals that looked like moose with grass up to their bellies. The German Antarctic expedition in 1938-39 led by Captain Richer with the research ship Schwabenland, which also gave New Swabia its name, suffered a similar fate. The Germans discovered an even more astonishing landscape halfway between the Waldat Massif and the ice cliffs of the coast. It was a low-lying, hilly area with many lakes that was completely free of ice and snow. The lakes, named Skirmaker Lakes after one of the flight captains, are among those areas in the Antarctic that practically beg to be explored on site. Men and Powers at the South Pole, The Conquest of a New Continent, Walter Sullivan, Forum Verlag, Vienna, Norbert Jürgen Rathov writes about the later whereabouts of the Hornbu developments in his book Time Machines as follows. The Hornbuell, 2&2 ice space flight gyroscopes and the Vril ice space flight discs themselves initially disappeared without a trace from May 1945 onwards. In this context, it is extremely interesting that the German Hornbu 2, after its 19th test flight, is said to have set off on April 20, 1945 from New Swabia, a huge, officially German territory in East Antarctica at the time, on a space expedition to Mars, the outcome of which is unknown. A year later, in 1946, however, numerous sightings of luminous objects of unknown origin and clearly artificial origin suddenly occurred over Scandinavia, causing considerable excitement among the Allies in East and West. A year later, in 1947, luminous flying objects, undoubtedly controlled by intelligences, began to appear over North America in ever-increasing numbers, initially well into the 1950s, with mostly round, discus or bell-like shapes, but sometimes also cigar-shaped unknown flying objects, known as UFOs for short. He goes on to write that these UFOs generally did not resemble the German developments. I disagree on this point. Well-documented photographic material proves that the Hornbu 2 version in particular has been cited very frequently since 1945. If, like me, you have spent a decade struggling through the UFO world, you will also find that in an exceptionally high percentage of cases in which personal contact with occupants of so-called UFOs occurred, these were particularly beautiful specimens of the Aryan species, blonde and blue-eyed, and they either spoke fluent German or another language with a German accent. For insiders, the Cedric Allingham case in 1954, the case of Howard Menger in 1956 and the Adamski case in 1952 are mentioned here. The alien whom George Adamski met several times had long blonde hair, blue eyes, wore brown overalls and had swastikas on the soles of his shoes. After one of the personal meetings, he later threw a roll of film that George Adamski had given him out of the saucer, with only one of the images exposed. There is a large swastika in the middle of a row of hieroglyphic characters. There are also 5 color photos of a flying disc that landed and then took off again, which had both a Borken cruise and a swastika painted on it, which were taken in 1979 by a night watchman in the Rhineland. 3 of these photos, one of which shows the Borken cruise, can be found in the picture section. The one with the swastika may not be shown in the Federal Republic of Germany, as it would again be interpreted, as in my first book, as the use of symbols of unconstitutional organizations, section 86 stpo. Those interested can find this particular photo in the video UFOs the Third Reich Strikes Back, produced in Austria. The question here is where the Vril company got the knowledge to build these flying objects, if not from the Aldebarans? And also the knowledge of genetic engineering, in which the Germans were said to have been miles ahead of other nations? Not to mention atomic physics, rocket technology and chemistry, including hydrogenation technology. Perhaps through the contact of Haushofer and Seb Ottendorf, the founders of the Thule and Vril Society, with the ascended masters in Tibet. We learn about the life and education of Germans in Tibetan monasteries not only from Lobsang Rampa and Russell MacLeod, the black son of Tashi Lunpo, but also from the book The Hermit published by a Mr. Felix Schmidt. And the Tibetans themselves claim that they have contact with the great white people who come from above. The first traveling white Europeans who reached the Himalayas were greeted by the Tibetan monks with the question why they were coming from below, otherwise they would come from above. According to Herbert G. Dorsey and other researchers, in addition to the construction plans of the Vril Society, the intact drive of an extraterrestrial saucer that crashed in the Black Forest in 1936 was of great help to the Germans through telepathic contact with extraterrestrials. However, there is almost no evidence of this, not to mention any living eyewitnesses. Another reference to the collaboration with the Aldebarans can be found in Robert Charu's book The Enigma of the Andes. In it, he reports on huge cave systems in the South American Andes. In the chapter The Scientific Center of Narciso Genovese, Charu relies on information from the physicist, philologist and humanist Narciso Genovese. Genovese was a student of the well-known Italian inventor Guglielmo Marconi. He claims that in 1938, after the death of their teacher, Marconi's students decided to continue his experiments and research into the use of solar and cosmic energy. This group of students, consisting of 98 scholars and technicians from various countries, joined together in a society and resolved to take all necessary precautions to prevent the misuse of their cosmic energy for war and criminal purposes. Having withdrawn to a lonely region of the Cordilleras, South American Andes, they subjected their community life to 3 months. On Earth there should be only a single religion, that of the true God or the universal intelligence, a single nation, the earthly fatherland, and a single politics, peace on the planet and understanding with the peoples of space. Robert Charu then writes on p. 165. Since the community did not lack resources thanks to the war treasures of Benito Mussolini and Adolf Hitler, 1. It built an underground city in South America, 2. Better equipped with laboratories, equipment and technical resources than Cape Kennedy, Kourou, Baikonur, Saclay or the CERN in Geneva. According to the report by N. Genovese, this research center has made astonishing scientific progress, not least thanks to extraterrestrial support. Since 1946 it has had a large collecting mirror for cosmic energy and, after initially exploiting the matter-antimatter contrast, is now able to obtain energy directly from the Sun. Notes. 1. Mussolini's war treasure was only partially recovered by the Italian partisans. The German Reich treasure is still being used today by the Third Black Force to build the future Reich. 2. The information about the location of the underground city varies widely. According to one, it is on the Altiplano, Peru. According to another, in the South American jungle, on the Amazon. At the end of August 1994, I conducted an interview with a member of the Black Sun, known by others as the Third Power or, as Charu calls it, the Third Black Force, who claimed to have been born in New Swabia. According to this man, he now lives in an underground city, together with 3 million Germans, 1994. According to him, they have underground and above ground bases all over the world. One of the underground bases is said to be under the Canary Islands. Another in the Bermuda Triangle, but in this case on the bottom of the ocean. With their flying discs, they can, according to him, easily glide underwater at high speeds. And when they stop on the sea floor, they can increase the magnetic field of the discs so that it pushes the water away from them and an underwater dome forms. Furthermore, they have a huge base in the Himalayas, at a height of well over 5,000 meters. According to him, The Germans are under the protection of the highest Tibetan lodge, the Djelugspa, the Yellow Caps and also the Aryanas, the inhabitants of the underground kingdom beneath the Himalayas. According to the statement of the member of the Black Sun, the Vril Germans are said to have a large standing army spread around the world, consisting of infiltrated Aldebarans, Aryanis and Germans, that could be deployed immediately if their help was needed somewhere. He also speaks of an armada of flying discs, which is why the USA and Russia set up the SDI program. But he also mentioned that they are never allowed to attack. That would be against cosmic law. They are only allowed to defend themselves in the event of an attack, for example in the event of a Third World War. If they are able to build flying discs that can cancel out gravity, that presupposes that they have understood the laws of the universe. Therefore, they must know what life is and therefore must not destroy life. Accordingly, a large proportion of them are probably vegetarians. The member of the Black Sun confirmed this. As a small example of contact between the Vril Germans and Aldebarans and Americans, I would like to show the following here to give you an idea of how they behave. The case of Reinhold Schmidt. On November 7 and 9, 1957, the daily newspaper Pfalz reported on the Californian grain merchant Reinhold Schmidt, who had direct contact with an alien spaceship and its crew in Kearney, Nebraska, USA, on November 5, 1957. In 1959, 2 years later, Schmidt reported in detail about his experience in a brochure. In the spaceship to the Arctic incident in Kearney, the German edition was published by Wendler Verlag, Wiesbaden. Reinhold Schmidt's exact words. The men were wearing street clothes, were approximately 1.80 meters tall and weighed an estimated 80 kilograms. The two women seemed to be about the same height, weighing about 58 to 60 kilograms and I estimate their age to be around 40 years. They all spoke to me in English, with what seems to me a German accent. To each other they spoke standard German, which I could understand, since I had been to a school where German was spoken as well as English, and I could speak, read and write German at the time. P. 13. While on board a ship, I was told not to start my car until they were completely out of sight, otherwise it would not move at all. This was the first time I knew that the ship had stopped my car. This engine stopping device was a development of the Germans during World War II, with which they tried to stop the electrical system of enemy bombers and also tanks. Reinhold Schmidt was then interviewed by countless reporters after his story was broadcast on television, but the very next day he was arrested on orders of high military authorities and later committed to a mental hospital. But because his case had already become too well known and Reinhold was also mentally healthy, he had to be released. On February 5, 1958, there was renewed contact with the spaceship and its occupants. He was about 32 kilometers west of Kearney when his car stopped again. When he asked in astonishment how he had been tracked down, he was told that it was because of his brain impulses. They took off for a short flight and then declared that they wanted to come back, which then happened on August 14, 1958. At 4:15 p.m. the flight to the Northern Polar Circle and the Arctic began. At times they reached 65,000 kilometers per hour and explained to him that the plane could fly much faster, but the distance was not great enough to really let it run free. This same ship can be used as an airplane in the air, as a ship on the water or as a submarine under the water. At the Northern Polar Circle they went with the spacecraft for about 4 hours at 120 meters, 400 feet below the surface. While we were below the surface of the water, I saw something that has never been made public before. I wrote to Washington for permission to publish this report. But up to the day I wrote this, I have heard nothing from the Pentagon. As I believe there is no need for further secrecy, I will now make these announcements. We observed two Russian submarines mapping the bottom of the ocean in order to establish bases from which they could fire missiles to any part of the world without warning and without making noise. The space enthusiasts told me that our government, USA, knows of this activity because three of our submarines are stationed there and because one of our small reconnaissance airships and some of our larger aircraft have flown over this area. The space enthusiasts told me that they will not allow the Russians to do this. They explained that if we could not prevent the Russians from attacking the underwater world without warning and without making a sound, they would do it themselves. I am sure that they are determined to do so. p. 40-41. When asked about a nuclear war, the pilots, for the American space enthusiasts, stated the following. They also said that they would not allow a nuclear war. They made it clear that they are impartial and do not take the side of any country, but that they will not stand by and watch our planet being destroyed by atomic bombs. Our radiation problem was also discussed. The space enthusiasts are now using a new invention to clean our atmosphere of the radiation from the explosion of atomic and hydrogen bombs. This agent is lowered from a great height and acts like an umbrella that covers a large area and not only cleans our air, but sometimes destroys the mechanism of the bomb itself. P. 41. Also of interest to our topic is Admiral Byrd's flight to the North Pole. When he flew deep into the polar region, he described vegetation and animals jumping around. Suddenly flying saucers appeared next to him and he wrote in his diary, "I can see a symbol, but I am not allowed to publish, announce it. I shall not reveal. That is imperative form." At the 1991 UFO conference in Phoenix, Arizona, I asked his nephew, Harley Byrd, what the symbol was, to which he replied, "A swastika, of course." When Admiral Byrd later landed, he found himself facing tall blonde giants who were obviously very advanced in their technical, but also spiritual, development. And when the discussion turned to the saucer-shaped flying discs, they speak English. The blonde master standing opposite him called them wing wheels in English. And later, when the pilots of the saucers say goodbye to Admiral Byrd over the radio, they say goodbye. This German greeting can be found in the middle of his English diary. And while I am writing this, I receive the following report in the mail. The author does not want to be named because he worked as a West German agent for the GDR state security for over a decade. In this letter dated March 11, 1997, he writes me the following. "As a Bundeswehr soldier, I took part in a winter night exercise in the Westerwald in 1959. I have a strange memory of a UFO landing that led to me being abducted, accompanied into the UFO, where I had to lie down on a table for a medical examination. German was spoken. I have not spoken to anyone about it yet so as not to be considered crazy. I then spontaneously sent him Karen and Rainer's first book and was excited to see his reaction. It came by letter on March 17, 1997, in which he wrote, 'Dear Mr. Van Helsing, thank you very much for the gift of the immensity of being,' which I read straight away in one breath and was thunderstruck when I saw the examination of people on beds described several times and thus finally confirmed. I know that during the night exercise, while deployed alone as a forward observer, I saw a discus-like flying object land in the dead of winter night. It was on stilts and a ladder was lowered under it in the middle. Suddenly I saw a ghostly, blurred, radiant spinning top-like thing approaching and landing silently from a cloud in deceptively dancing, lightning-fast maneuvers, comparable to a hummingbird nectar feeding. The spinning top stopped at a height of 23 meters above the site. Hydraulically activated stilts were extended, then a gangway-like on passenger aircraft was lowered. The dome had numerous brightly lit windows in which heads and upper bodies were visible. Although I could not normally be seen quickly either from the front or from the air, a headlight of the strange aircraft suddenly flashed and rushed straight towards me. Three or four men came down the gangway and straight to me, with the possible greeting. 'Hello, comrade. You must be damn cold, lying on the ground for hours and not being allowed to move. Come in and have a cup of coffee, would you like?' I neither understood the anomaly of the situation, nor did I, the dutiful soldier, think of my duty of observation and security. In the midst of my new comrades, I boarded the flying saucer via the gangway, saw the windows in the circular command room and there, closed, control panels running all around. My new comrades wore a bluish-white flight suit with a strange emblem on the right upper arm, a white circle with a black triangle, the one with the point facing downwards.